Good afternoon and welcome to the Cato Institute. My name is Marian Tupi and I'm the Assistant Director of the Project on Global Economic Liberty here at the Cato Institute. In 1989, communism collapsed in Central Europe. Later, it collapsed throughout the rest of the Soviet Empire. There was much optimism in the air as people had thrown off the shackles of communist central planning and of political oppression and have opted for liberal market democracy. Yet not all countries have succeeded equally. Let me give you an example. Estonia, between 1995 and 2004, Estonian GDP per capita has risen by an incredible 95%. The country has been growing at 6.7% per annum. In contrast, other countries, especially further east, have not done so well. One can look at Ukraine. One can look, of course, at Georgia. Some of the countries have not attempted any reform at all. Look at Belarus. And 17 years after the collapse of communism in Central Europe, 15 years after the collapse of communism in the rest of the Soviet Empire, we are very privileged to see a new book come out on the economic transformation in Central and Eastern Europe. And it's a book by Oleg Havrilishin, Divergent Paths in Post-Communist Transformation, Capitalism for All or Capitalism for the Few. Allow me to begin by quoting from Oleg's book. In less than 20 years since the collapse of communism in Europe, yet from the perspective of the early 21st century, the events triggered by the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989 seem much more distant. Even for those directly involved, it can be hard to recall what life was like in the centrally planned economies, and correspondingly, easy to overlook the scale of the challenge that faced those charged with transforming those countries into market economies. This is at least in part because so much has been achieved so fast. Many of the countries crippled by economic policies that wasted resources on a huge scale, stifled growth, and held down living standards are now in the European Union. The transformation of many parts of the former Soviet Empire has been remarkable. Turning centrally-run economies into well-functioning market economies that fosters competition and growth has never before been attempted. The early years of the process were punctuated by intense debates among economists and policymakers about the best way to achieve the desired objective. In particular, there were arguments about whether speed or caution would be more effective route. Well, in this book, Oleg Havrilishin concludes that the Big Bang approach to economic reform has been more successful than the more gradualist approach that was adopted by some of the former communist countries. He also concludes that countries which adopted more advanced economic reforms and had the opportunity to join the European Union sometime in the future have done much better than countries that did not have that opportunity. And so I'm very pleased to welcome Oleg Havrilishin to the Cato Institute today. Oleg was born in Ukraine, and his parents fled from communists, first to Brazil and then to Canada. He's received his Bachelor of Arts in Economics at Queen's University and PhD in Economics from MIT. He's had an academic career for 20 years, first at Queen's University and then at Georgetown University. George Washington. I apologize. How could I ever make a mistake like that? He specialized in trade and development and has worked on many consulting assignments for the World Bank and later for the IMF. Well, his career, I could go on and on, but let me just say that he has recently retired from the IMF and went to the University of Toronto, where he is currently teaching. Ladies and gentlemen, please let me welcome Oleg Havrilishin.
Yeah, awesome. Well, thank you very much, Marian, for this very pleasant-to-listen-to introduction. Whenever I do occasionally give a presentation and I'm introduced, I have to listen twice to realize, is this me or not? So it's very nice of you, Marian. And thank you very much for the opportunity to address the members of the Cato Institute and others present, giving you my views of what has happened in the last 15 years, why it happened the way it did, and what next. Let me motivate the philosophical issue that comes at the very end of my talk with a citation at the beginning that I will read from the New York Times op-ed of October 30, 2003 by Leon Aron, Crime and Punishment for Capitalists. And I cite a couple of sentences that there is in Russia a battle between two economic cultures. He's writing about the Yukos, the beginning of the Yukos affair. Battle between two economic cultures, on the one side, the great power statists versus the liberal oligarchic. I find the phrase liberal oligarchic to be an absolute oxymoron, and I will try to explain why. I quote one more sentence, the last sentence in Aron's statement: the oligarchs can help to advance the cause of Russian democracy. I don't take umbrage of that because I'm Ukrainian and not Russian, but I do take an opposing view to that, and I will try to explain through a political economy model why that is, in fact, absolutely the opposite of what one should conclude about oligarchic regimes. Well, this is just a nice picture of the cover of my book, which is a display copy is available. And for those of you who don't mind extortionate capitalists like Palgrave Macmillan, they'll kill me for this, charging hugely ridiculous prices at the first run, there are order forms with a discount for conference purposes. I'm hoping that that'll be over in 6-12 months and they'll come down to more affordable prices. What am I going to talk about today? Five subsections very briefly. What was the expectation like in 1989? What are the outcomes that we can see 15 years later? Why do we see the different outcomes? And by the way, just as a prelude, a fundamental, simple way of seeing what I see is group one of countries comes out as liberal democracies, and liberal applies to both the polity and the economy, roughly speaking at least, versus group two, oligarchic, or what has come to be known sometimes as captured states in the new political science literature. Then I will talk a little bit about the prospects for transition being completed in these captured states, and then, if necessary, a bit of summing up. And Marian will help me by reminding me how much time I have left, I hope, so that I can skip a few of these slides. This slideshow will be available on the Cato website in due time, I am told. So some of these things I will go through very quickly and skip them. They can be picked up later. At the beginning, late 80s, early 90s, the expectations were started with huge euphoria and optimism. These enslaved people have been freed. It was expected that there would be some social pain, but everybody thought that even though there are some winners and some losers at the beginning, that everybody would be better off in a short period of time. So it was more euphoric than realistic. The issues, the key issues that were debated was whether you go fast or slow moving to the market. What do you do first? What is the sequence? Do you privatize first? Do you set up regulations of monopolies first? Do you liberalize prices first? Do you liberalize foreign trade first? This, that, and the other. And a very important debate had to do with how to mitigate the adjustment costs of any social pain, because you had to get rid of all of these highly inefficient factories with huge numbers of inefficient workers. So there's going to be pain. So the years of euphoria, 89-92, are nicely represented by this old East German Trabant, in the notion that if you just dump it, that capitalism will blossom. Guess what? Many of these Trabants have been pulled out of these dumps. And capitalism has blossomed. There's an outfit in Poland called crazyguys.com that organizes nostalgia trips around the country to see old Soviet-style architecture, this, that, and the other, driving in an old Trabant. So capitalism did blossom for a few, even in a way that was unexpected. Very quickly, the euphoria was worn thin, and what you had as represented in this Izvestia cartoon, that reforms just lead to worse and worse material conditions, these open sardine cans. These were years of despair. A very important point to note here, this is serious business, because the popular perception got rooted very early and remains to the present day, not only amongst the populace, but amongst a lot of academics, that reforms cause pain. I will try to show later that that, in fact, is not necessarily true. Then there was the role of the IMF, as here. The sign says, in Russian, collective farm named after the third tranche of the International Monetary Fund. So there was hope that the pain of reforms would be salvaged and overcome by international support. I want to talk a little bit more seriously about what I think is the perhaps the simple, most synthetic statement of the debates in the early period, the Big Bang versus gradualism debate. The arguments for gradual reforms were that you need to allow time to create industries and jobs as the old ones were eliminated and thereby reduce social pain. Not throw everybody out of these dinosaur factories and hope that capitalism will pick them up, but go slowly. The most important recommendation of this school of thought, represented by Gerard Roland, for example, is to put in place market institutions before putting fully in place the liberalization of markets. The Big Bang argument was that you needed to change the incentives quickly to close the rent-seeking opportunities and lobbying by the existing bureaucracy of red directors, and to prevent opponents of reform to delay process for their own interests. By the way, this is not new. You go back and read Ann Krieger and rent-seeking and liberalization of trade in Latin America and elsewhere. This is a fundamental notion. You've got to move quickly enough, otherwise you'll get opposition to reform. So I don't claim novelty here. There's an important parallel debate in the political science literature about whether you could have democratization and economic liberalization at the same time. I simplify, of course. Professor Przeworski of Chicago will not think that this is necessarily his view. Market reforms, because they cause pain, this school of thought of Przeworski's said, will, in a democracy, mean that in the next elections, the reformists are thrown out and back come the renamed communists, because most communists switch to some kind of a centrist socialist party. And then they will reverse the reforms. Just to stay in Poland, or at least with Polish intellectuals, Balcerowicz, Leszek Balcerowicz of Poland, argued that in fact the two were compatible in the sense that the democratization provided a honeymoon period where everybody agreed we want to do something different, and this is the time to take the historical opportunity to move from communism to liberalism and markets and policies as soon as possible. A political scientist by the name of Valerie Bunce has given this, I think, a nice name, the dual liberal vision, liberal economy, liberal polity. So that was the debate. How about the outcomes? Well, first, before we talk about the outcomes, there's a problem of how to measure. When you're moving a whole regime, a society, from a communist, central plan, socialist, I mean, you've got not just economics and politics, you've got attitudinal, Weltanschauung issues, this, that, and the other. You're moving into a completely different mindset, to a completely different set of institutions and rules. How do you measure outcomes? There are many different ways. You can measure economic performance after a certain period of time. You can measure, have some measures of degree of democracy and how well democracy, real liberal democracy, is evolving. You can measure poverty and income distribution. You can measure social indicators of direct sort, life expectancy, health indicators, infant mortality. You can define, if not measure, what political scientists might describe as the typology of the regime. Is it autocratic? Is it something in between? And so forth. You can measure things like the formation of vested interests, which I call here the formation of oligarchs. There are many different sources for measuring these things, so we do have some quantitative grip on this. I don't want to overstate the extent to which you can do these things in hard econometrics. And any econometrics I do, no econometrician would consider anything but very, very soft first-year econometrics. But there are quantitative indicators. How far has the regime or the economy moved towards being a market-type economy has actually measured quantitatively year by year since about 1991 by the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development. And they've got this thing called the Transition Progress Indicator. Economic performance, of course, you've got GDP growth, you've got inflation, you've got foreign direct investment, and perhaps others. Social indicators are social well-being. Well, we can turn to all sorts of indicators of poverty, income distribution, literacy, health, and the overall so-called Human Development Index of the UNDP. Degree of democracy, well, I won't get into that, but there are many institutions in this city, just up the street a little bit, that do regular measures, whether it's the Heritage Foundation or somebody else, measures year by year of a some degree of democracy or a spectrum on a non-democratic to fully democratic typology for each country in the world. Institutions of the rule of law. There are institutional measures that are quantitative. And then you can define types of political regime on the spectrum of democratic to autocratic. Well, when you got so much, how do you handle this? This was one of my biggest fears when I started doing this work of going back and trying to figure out what happened. But I won't convince everybody, but I was pleased to find that the EBRD measure of transition progress indicator turns out statistically to be an excellent proxy, because it moves much the same way as all sorts of other measures that you might want to measure. It's a judgmental measure. It is a bunch of experts every year saying where on that scale from 1 to 4.3, I have no idea why they chose 4.3, but that's the most, shall we say, liberal market economy you can have in the world. Every year some experts would give values for 8 different sub-indices, and then they say don't do an average. The World Bank says don't do averages of what they do. The World Bank does averages of what they do. The EBRD does averages of these sub-indices. I did averages of these sub-indices. So what I will show you is an average of their 8 different indices of market liberalization. And it turns out to have a strong statistical correlation with other outcome measures, which is what I want to show you. In the slideshow itself, there's a couple of other tables on performance, GDP growth, and so on, but I won't talk about it. First, I want to take the EBRD transition indicator and quickly go through 27 countries that are post-communist countries. I chose the title post-communist in order to avoid the immediate criticism of experts in the field. Just, but you didn't talk about China. But post-communist. I have an economist reason for saying China's model does not apply, but there's this other reason. This is just essentially the European, Eurasian, Central Asian group of countries, which there are now 27. There may be 28 as soon as Kosovo becomes independent. Anyway, for these countries, the transition progress indicator in the year 2004 allowed me to group them in a way that has double meaning. First, you have all of Central Europe, Hungary, Czech Republic, Poland, Slovakia, Croatia, and Slovenia in this first group. Then you have the three Baltic countries. Then you have Southeast Europe, Bulgaria, Romania, Macedonia, Albania, Bosnia-Herzegovina, Serbia, Montenegro. Oh, actually, we already have 28, so we're going to have 29 with Kosovo. In the next group, and then all the rest of them are CIS countries, Commonwealth of Independent States. Those two neatly fall into two groups, more or less neatly. Easier to describe the tail end. These are the laggard or virtually non-reformist three states of Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, and Belarus, where the degree of progress from a Soviet-style economy is absolutely minimal. Whereas the rest of these CIS countries, all the others, Russia, Ukraine, Armenia, etc., Kyrgyz Republic, are countries that have done a considerable amount of reforming, a lot of privatization, a lot of liberalization, at least partial, and a lot of institutional legal change and so on and so forth, a lot of opening up of trade, which you don't get in Belarus and Uzbekistan. What you see, first of all, is that you get a pretty neat grouping into five groups of countries. Central Europe, Baltics, Southeast Europe, mild reform CIS countries, or moderate reformers in the CIS, and limited reformers. And I use these groups henceforth in my study to try to see, for group by group, whether other sorts of events in transition conform to this hierarchy of Central Europe, Baltic, Southeast Europe, CIS moderate reform, CIS limited reform. This is an example of economic recovery. You get a rough grouping that falls, you get a rough ranking that falls more or less the same way, especially if you make some adjustments to the official statistics. I'm not going to go into, except maybe in question period, why the official statistics simply are not acceptable. But let me give you one fundamental reason, and I'll blame the EBRD. They're being too political. When they have a table every single year in their transition report which shows GDP since 1989 to the present day, and then they have it in index form with 1989 being 100. That clearly says the benchmark is 89. How bad did GDP perform since 89? That tells you. It doesn't tell you how bad GDP performed since transition began, because very few countries began transition in 1989. Poland is perhaps the sole exception where serious transition began as early as 89. All of the other countries delayed the beginning of their transition at least a year, two, if not four or five. You make just a little bit of adjustment to change the benchmark to when the process of reforming the economy began, and you don't see nearly as much of a decline in GDP as is taunted by those, like a Canadian colleague of mine who won the Nobel Prize recently. He worries mostly about single currency, but Bob Mundell is a great exponent of the fact that this is the greatest depression since the 1930s. I think Bob Mundell is wrong because he's using this 1989 as a benchmark. Anyway, financial stability, FDI per capita, there are tables I won't go to. I want to make the point that the transition progress indicator correlates statistically very well with two important non-economic indicators of progress in transition. The first is democratization. The statistical correlation, I'm not sure whether you can read it or not, but we've got 27 countries in which we do a simple regression of an index of constitutional liberalism, media freedom, the degree of openness of elections, and so on, and the EBRD transition progress indicator. You get a pretty high statistical correlation for such a small sample. I'll come back to the implication of this because it has to do with the Przeworski hypothesis. And then human development indicators. A lot of the criticism of rapid economic reform comes from the concern, well-placed, absolutely well-placed concern, that it's going to cause social pain and that therefore one should not go quickly. Well, if you look at GDP growth, this critics will say, yeah, but that doesn't measure social impact. All right, let's go to the source for social well-being. What's that? the United Nations Development Program Annual Human Development Report, which has a big table at the back called the Human Development Index, composed of various social indicators, life expectancy, health, access to safe water, rights of women, and so on and so forth. What do you see happen to the Human Development Indicator over time between 1990 and 11, 12 years later, as you go across the group of more quickly reforming and more slowly reforming countries? First of all, you see that in Central Europe, there was really, in the first over a five-year period, I didn't measure the first year, there may have been a different trend, but there was no decline in the Human Development Indicator at all. And by 2001, they were back on the trajectory of moving forward with the rest of the world. In the Baltics, there was a sharp decline for 5 years, but they recuperated that in the next seven and surpassed the original Soviet period 1990 value of HDI. In Southeast Europe, you get much the same performance as in the Baltics. The place where you see social pain being the greatest is in the CIS moderate reformers. Greater than, there's some doubts about the measures for Belarus and so on, but let's take them at face value, greater than in the CIS countries with limited reform. What does that tell you? It tells me, if you take the whole package together, that if you don't reform at all, you're not going to cause much social pain. Okay, but no pain, no gain. You haven't moved forward. So you're an example for not moving, not an example for how to move. If you reform quickly, you overcome the pain more quickly and you move into an upward trajectory more quickly. If you delay reform, which is what the CISM group is all about, long delays in starting reform, and very slow and partial reforms, or in the case of the misnamed Big Bang example of Russia, it wasn't a Big Bang. It was an aborted Big Bang, which lasted for 6.5, 7 months. In the case of Russia, If you don't put these things in fully in sufficiently quick time, if you have partial reform, delayed, partial, slow reform is what causes the greatest social pain. These are not IMF World Bank statistics. These are the statistics from the school of thought that most sharply criticizes the economists, from the United Nations sources, which, by the way, don't use these statistics to come to the same conclusions on the disaster of the greatest disaster since the Depression that was caused in poverty. The 1998 report of the United Nations Development Program presents these statistics but doesn't draw the conclusion that they ought to draw. They say this is terrible. Huge amount of poverty, maldistribution of income, and so forth. All right, let me finish off on the outcomes by talking about regime types. I think you can categorize the 27 countries, roughly speaking, and I'm not a political scientist, so I'm not putting a lot of weight on this, into four groups now. One is we have societies that tend to be pretty much on the liberal end of the spectrum, with what I like to think of as capitalism for all. Everybody has a chance to be a capitalist. Open markets. And this includes Central Europe. This includes the Baltics. And marginally now, we can think of including countries like Bulgaria, Croatia, and Romania in that group. We still have a group of countries where the direction of the polity is undetermined in Southeast Europe. We have Macedonia. We have, of course, Kosovo as a non-sovereign entity, but an entity. We have Serbia, Montenegro. We have Albania. These are on the margin. We have oligarch societies, which includes not all, but a large proportion of the CISM group, the CIS countries with moderate reforms. Of course, most obviously in Ukraine, Russia, Kazakhstan, Azerbaijan, less so in some of the other countries, but societies in which the state has been captured by a small number of vested interests. And we have the unreformed polities that have barely moved from being Soviet-style economies and polities. A cute little diagram, a cute little, if you will, table, which you can look at on the website. I won't spend a lot of time on it. That the concentration of billionaires could be thought of as a quantitative indicator of oligarchy. And not surprisingly, Russia tops the list in proportional terms. The proportion has not been formed here. I really should have done that. It's the percent of billionaires over the percent of world GDP, second to last column over the last column. It's much higher in Russia than it is anywhere else. In the U.S., it's not much over one. Surprisingly, the welfare state economies of Sweden and Canada have a lot of billionaires. The 2006 numbers for Forbes, by the way, give Russia even more, and Ukraine is now up to 7 billionaires. So the concentration for Ukraine suddenly becomes more like Russia. I don't mean that to be unserious, neither do I mean it to be serious. I mean, it's only a tip of the iceberg what the number of billionaires is. Lots of countries have lots of billionaires. A couple of preliminary conclusions on the outcome related to the early debates. First, there's a wide divergence of outcomes. There was no one single outcome by any means. Secondly, you do get countries which you can say that you now have real open markets with capitalism and competitive market economies, open economies. And then you have another group of countries in which you have non-competitive markets. You have markets. How Russia Became a Market Economy, a title of a book by my good friend Anders Aslund, is absolutely correct. It did become a market economy, but it's a non-competitive market, which is different from a competitive and liberal market. The Przeworski hypothesis is not confirmed by the facts, because in the end, for reasons I won't go into, I discuss it in the book, in the end, market liberality and political liberality are complements rather than trade-offs. Certainly, this was the case in the post-communist world. I am not a political scientist. I don't really know very well the literature of political science on the relationship of democracy and markets, going back to Huntington and others. But in the post-communist world, it is clearly a positive correlation. And last preliminary conclusion, the gradualist strategy for easing social costs is not confirmed by outcomes 15 years later. On the contrary, the more rapid the reforms, the lower were social costs, and the earlier they were overcome. Why these divergent outcomes was the next question I asked. And I'll try to go more quickly if we need to here. Why divergent outcomes? There are 27 different stories you can tell. So one approach to this study of this is to do a very good, thorough study of a particular country. And there are many of those, and I relied on many of those. There are, for Poland, just in English, never mind what there may be in Polish, there are a good handful of studies by key players like Grzegorz Kolodko and Leszek Balcerowicz, manuscript-length discussions of what happened. The problem I had with that approach was that 27 different stories make it difficult to see the forest for the trees. And I wanted to see whether there were some minimal set of main driving forces that go some way, a considerable way, to explain the differences in outcome. And what I came up with, I think you'd have to call a political economy model, and I've got an effort, probably mistaken, but an effort to in an appendix of one of my chapters of a mathematical version thereof. Three main factors correlate together or work together to determine whether a country would go in this direction or that direction, more successful, less successful. First, how long were the reforms debated and delayed at the beginning? Secondly, how powerful were the vested interests that were there early on or even before the start to take advantage of any rent-seeking opportunities? And third, how important was reform discipline coming from the outside, external conditionality of international club memberships like the EU or the Bretton Woods institutions or the WTO, etc.? I probably won't have time to get into the details, so let me give you the conclusion. The EU was by far, or EU membership was by far, the most important of any outside disciplining efforts that contributed to good movement in reform. The navigation model that I have, I will go to this vicious circle diagram to explain it. I call it a navigation model because the oligarchs I call pirates, and the debate about not knowing where to go, uncharted waters. Well, this is the vicious circle, and there's a virtuous circle, the opposite of this. If you start with the point here, suppose the reforms are delayed for good reason or bad. The longer you delay a reform, the greater the opportunities for rent-seeking and possible revival of an old elite or development of a new elite. Look, if you have privatization alone, you already can start to have vested interests look for rent opportunities. And privatization actually began in 87, 88 in Russia and earlier in other countries. But you don't have liberalization, you don't have competitive laws and regulations and so forth. If you have these delays for a long time and they're big enough, the rent-seeking opportunities provide the possibility for development of high concentrations of capital ownership, the oligarchy development, and the capture of the state for policy self-interest. And, of course, the entrenched elite, the new elite, economic elite, is not in favor of competition. They prefer the status quo. They prefer non-transparent procedures. They prefer to avoid the discipline of EU membership, because the one thing that EU membership brings is not only continual momentum forward, but an increasing degree of openness and transparency, according to the Acquis Communautaire 32 chapters. This makes it more difficult for small and medium enterprises, for new entrants. They continue to face difficulties while the big entities have their way. You also, therefore, have weak rule of law, weak support for EU membership, and this going outside the loop has an effect on Brussels. Brussels doesn't just simply say, oh, we're going to offer EU membership to this candidate but not to that one. That depends a little bit on how they read the preparedness of different candidates to go through this 10, 15-year process of doing all these changes. That's a lot of politics in it as well. But if they read that Ukraine, Moldova are not going in the direction that's desirable and they themselves have a power elite that doesn't want it, they're not going to offer membership automatically. The World Bank has done the State Capture Index, and I have used it to do a little bit of simple econometrics, that the higher the degree of state capture in the longer the delay in beginning the first step in economic transformation, that is stabilization of the hyperinflation, and I measure it by the number of months it takes to reach 5% per month inflation, the longer it takes to start, the longer the delay in stabilization, the higher the state capture index. Again, with a reasonably decent set of correlations and significance for the statistics. Similarly, the bigger the first step in reforms, which is transition progress indicator after 4 years from the start, the lower the degree of state capture. So if you delay stabilization, delay reform, state capture will be higher. If you move quickly, state capture will be lower, which is an important part of the hypothesis of the model. This is just a table where both variables are regressed. Let me then turn finally to the last point about what are the prospects for what are the now captured states. The old debate about gradualism versus Big Bang is nice historically to write about and try to conclude. But it is history, because everybody's gone too far with the exception of three, and that's not important enough. In the future, the new important debate, and this is where the Aron article was relevant, is the transition inevitably going to continue once it started, or is the transition frozen? The transition inevitable argument, and it's not fair to draw straw men, but approximately in some of the writings of André Schleifer, of Osland, and so on, you get these arguments based on the Coase theorem that if there's a in a market there's a demand for anything, including institutions, they will generate a supply. Yesterday's thief is tomorrow's staunchest defender of property rights. Means that once a person becomes a capitalist, a big capitalist especially, they will want to have secure property rights for their property. They will therefore demand that the government impose property rights institutions. Not so fast. That certainly is not the history of Latin America as I understand it, or of entrenched elites, as the Journal of Economic Literature article of Moore et al. Last year described. There is a counter-argument, and it has been best and most rigorously defined in mathematical models by Polishchuk and Savatey of 2004 and Son in 2003, which says, wait a minute, these entrenched elites or vested interests or oligarchs, they're maximizing profits, right? Or rents. How do you maximize them? Well, there are many different ways. One way is to secure your property rights. The other way is to buy your property rights non-transparently. Sometimes transparently because you have an army of protectors and hired guns, literally, non-transparently from the government. They don't touch you. They touch the medium-sized guys. And you continue to use your influence on the government to make sure that the kind of government that is in place, and that is the meaning of state capture, is favorable to you, and the kind of policies they enforce or put in place are most favorable to your profits. So, in fact, you can argue that entrenched elites will delay and freeze the transition process. It's too early to tell, but a very quick and dirty econometric estimate of this is in this chart, that state capture leads to frozen transition. That if I look at the degree of state capture in 99, and I look 5 years later at how far countries have gone on transition progress indicator, I get this negative relationship. In other words, the higher the degree of state capture, the less future progress was in transition. I think we will finish this at this point. There may be some questions about... Now, where is this? Okay. There may be some questions that I wanted to... The only other thing I wanted to raise, but maybe in question period, is what can you do? Is there anything that you can do to overcome this captured state situation? Thank you.
Thank you. Well, Olaf, thank you so very much for that presentation. It was really comprehensive and very interesting. I'm sure there will be time for questions. But before we go to question and answer session, I am delighted to welcome to the Cato Institute the ambassador of the Polish Republic, Janusz Reiter. Mr. Reiter is a diplomat and a foreign policy expert, as well as a political writer, who was born in 1952 in Kościernica, Poland. I probably mispronounced it, but that's Polish for you. He has graduated in 1976 from Warsaw University in German philology, which I wonder if... was any useful when he then later became the Polish ambassador to the Federal Republic of Germany. But he has, in the years between 1984 and 89, he was a commentator for the independent weekly Przegląd Katolicki, and from 1990 to 1985, as I said, he was the ambassador to Germany. He later became president of the Center for International Relations in Poland. The ambassador has kindly agreed to come and join us, and please let me welcome into the Cato Institute.
Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me to speak about this book. Let me say that I really believe the book offers a lot of valuable insights. And my first reaction was, if we only had this book back in 1989, 1990, we could have done a much better job. But we did not. It's obvious the hardest things are predictions, particularly about the future. And this is why there were so many failed attempts to write about transformation in the early 90s, and so many books whose authors would be happy to forget about the books and to make them forgotten. I think this is a book that really is based on reliable data, and a book that doesn't have false aspirations, a book that provides a lot of, as I said, a lot of insights, a book that provides a solid, reliable analysis. Let me also say, make at the beginning a remark on IMF, the World Bank, and other international institutions, the role they played in Central and Eastern Europe and in other regions. Because I think it's interesting to know that the perception of the IMF and the World Bank, for example, in Poland and in Central Europe, was very different from this in other countries. Also, very different from, for example, for Russia or Ukraine. I think the reason was that the IMF and the World Bank found in Central Europe pretty well-prepared elites who took the responsibility for their countries. They found some well-prepared, well-skilled young professionals, but not only that. There were political elites who took the responsibility for the reform process. As an example, the Polish Prime Minister elected in September 1989, Tadeusz Mazowiecki, was a political leader. He didn't know very much about economy, but he had a sense of what should have been done. And he was the one who hired Leszek Balcerowicz, who became then a political leader and an expert on market economy. And that was an ideal composition. And there was no doubt that it was these two people, Mazowiecki and Balcerowicz, who took the responsibility for the outcome of the reform, and not the World Bank, and not the IMF, and not the other advisors from the Western countries. The leaders in the Central European countries, they absorbed the expertise from the international institutions, and they transformed it into policy for their countries. And finally, as I said, they took responsibility for the outcome of the process. So there was no clash between the advisors, between the international institutions and an unprepared society, with the results which led then in other cases to blaming IMF and the World Bank and the Western experts on the failures of the reforms. The failures were caused by the elites in the countries and not by the international experts. And the stronger the national elite was, the less likely was a clash between the Western experts and the local communities. Well, then, after the initial period of a few years, the IMF and the World Bank were replaced in their function as a provider of navigation paradigm, as Mr. Havrilishin says, by the European Union, that did then an excellent job and had much more influence than the financial institutions, because it had much more incentives than the IMF or the World Bank. Let me add that the existence of strong elites was a conditio sine qua non for the success of the reform process. There was a certain democracy paradox in these countries, as I formulated. democracy was a widely accepted idea. There was no doubt about it in Central Europe, also maybe at the beginning in Eastern Europe. But the democratic mechanisms and structures were extremely weak. In the communist time, the dominant factor of the social stratification was the distance towards the power and not social differences. The economic differences were of minor importance. And at the starting point in 1989-1990, there were no well-formed interest groups in the Central and Eastern European countries. And there was little awareness of specific interests of the various interest groups. The Polish Solidarity was a wide movement of 10 million people. So one could wonder, could 10 million people have equal interests in a free democratic society? Not necessarily. But this movement was formed by the old divisions of the communist time. And that was what brought 10 million people together, and not the awareness of shared interests in a free and democratic society. The weakness of the democratic society, in a certain sense, it may sound cynical, but it is not cynical, offered a unique opportunity to the reformers in these countries. And if they used the momentum, if they used the opportunity, as they did in Poland and in other countries of Central Europe, they could make a huge progress. And that was exactly the case in Poland. Plus, in Poland, there was another element. The communist system collapsed in an unprecedented way. So there was no room for any nostalgia. And another element that was, as I believe, important for all post-communist countries in Central Europe was that maybe for the first time in the modern history, there was no East-West choice for these countries, because the East, represented by Russia, had nothing to offer. So Mr. Havlicek was speaking about the expectations back in 1989-1990. The expectations were on the one hand very vague. People wanted to be like in Western Europe, like the European Union. But on the other hand, the expectations were very concrete. People wanted to escape the former Eastern Bloc. There was a negative point of reference. That was Russia, with the unprecedented level of decline in economic and social decline, and also loss of political authority and political attractiveness. That made particularly in the Polish case the choice between the gradualist concept and the Big Bang concept, well, actually a very abstract choice. There was in the concrete situation no real choice. The gradual approach was sometimes offered or sometimes supported more as a pretext to avoid reforms, or as a pretext to leave the control over the economy and over the state to the small group of the so-called nomenklatura. And let me say that, without going into details, the problem of the so-called nomenklatura, I will then make another remark on that, was faced in all countries. And there were differences in how the problem was addressed, but this is what I'd like to return to a little later. Let me just mention here that, paradoxically, in Central Europe, both the post-communist elites and their critics were in favor of joining the EU, of EU accession, for different reasons. Because for the former communist elite, joining the EU was the hope to live in a safe political environment. They hoped the EU to protect them, so to speak, against the anti-communist forces and elites in their countries. And for the critics of the post-communists, the EU was, so to speak, the leverage to break up the structures of the post-communist society and post-communist market economy. So that was the situation. That was the situation when until 2004, when 10 new countries joined the European Union. The European Union played an enormous role in this process. Let me say a few words about that. The EU is a meritocratic organization. It is very successful if it combines the meritocratic approach with a political vision. And sometimes it does. It fails when it relies only on the meritocratic approach and has no political vision. That happens sometimes too. The ideal candidates for EU membership, as the EU looks at that, are countries like Norway and Switzerland. But exactly the two countries that don't want to join the European Union. So, if a country is as ideal as the EU wishes it to be, then it doesn't want to join the European Union. But if it wants to join the European Union, it is far from being ideal. And this is the dialectic process of the relationship between the EU and the candidates. Now, the EU has been very successful in the combination of the meritocratic approach and the political vision for the 10 new countries, even if there were some hard debates on that. What about Ukraine? I think that Mr. Havrilishyn is absolutely right in stating that the European Union has failed to develop the right strategy on Ukraine. Even if Ukraine should be admitted, an extremely complicated case. But in this case, the EU relied too much on its meritocratic approach and was too little able to develop a political vision. To be fair, I think it is important to add that that Ukraine, contrary to that, has relied too much on the political vision and neglected the necessity of making the reforms. It has to rely on the EU as a political process and has failed to recognize the nature of the meritocratic process. And that is the other contribution to the failure of to this grand failure. Particularly, the pre-Orange governments in Ukraine have failed to make the necessary efforts, and that has very negatively affected the way how the Ukraine was perceived in Western Europe, in the European Union. However, where the European Union has failed was the response to the Orange Revolution. That was certainly a failure, even if the Orange Revolution was not able to form the country as deeply as one could wish. The Orange Revolution showed that Ukraine was a country with genuinely pro-European inclinations, and these inclinations should have been encouraged and supported by the European Union. The European neighborhood policy is only an ersatz for such a vision. It is only an ersatz because there can be no common policy towards such so different countries as Morocco, Egypt, Moldova, and Ukraine, unless the strategy is to keep all of these countries out. And this is exactly the suspicion that people in Ukraine have, that the strategy is to keep Ukraine out. Let me at the end add that certainly the problem of the oligarchic structure is a problem of Russia, Ukraine, and the post-Soviet space. But there is a problem of the post-communist elites in the successful Central European countries, and this problem is now again being discussed more than in the previous years. Paradoxically, I cannot go now into details. Finally, is the transformation in the Central European countries completed, or is it still an unfinished business? I believe very much that the transformation is completed, which doesn't mean that there is no need for reforms. However, there is a need for reforms also in Western Europe. But this is a different sort of reforms that we need today than the reforms that were done in the past. And to return to Central Europe, I think the time of adaptation is over. Now it's the time for making choices. The time of adaptation was the time of taking over the acquis communautaire. And the situation was very simple. It was a take it or leave it situation. We had to accept the acquis communautaire or we would not be accepted as candidates for EU membership. Today, the new members of the EU have to make their own choices, knowing that there is no European model that offers simple answers to their problems. There are different models. There is a different Scandinavian model. There is a different Anglo-Saxon model in the UK. There is another model in France and Germany. Even if Germany maybe should be separated from France, so it's much more difficult to make the choices in today's environment than at the beginning of this process. If what makes me confident for this group of countries is that after 16 or 17 years of reforms, unlike in Western Europe, people in these countries know that changes are not an exception, but the norm. And maybe this is why they might be pretty well prepared for additional changes, means reforms. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ambassador. We will move straight away to question and answer session. We only have the Ambassador for the next 5 minutes, so if there are questions directly or directed to him, let us take those first. Anybody questions for the Polish Ambassador? Right in the back, do I see a question?
No. Yes? Okay. I was wondering, you mentioned that further reforms were really based upon the need for Western Europe to reform. And following up on that a little bit, I wondered if you had noticed in any of the Western European countries, if they had taken anything from the example of the former communist countries in terms of things that they should not be doing. Have there been any lessons learned from the communist countries for the Western European countries in terms of social policy, social welfare, anything like that?
Well, let me first say that the Central European countries are advocating liberal reforms in the European Union. They have a genuine interest in the reforms, in liberal reforms of the European Union. At least now, it may change. They may become status quo oriented in the future. To give you an example, the common agricultural policy. Poland today, one of the biggest agricultures in the European Union, is interested in a deep reform of the agricultural policy. Why? Well, because Poland is not fully involved into the CAP. Once it is fully involved in the CAP, I wonder whether it will be interested in promoting reforms. It's that simple. I mean, there might be, there will be politicians and economists who will advocate such reforms, but there will be such a strong, powerful lobby of farmers that will be interested in maintaining status quo. And then I think it might be too late. So now, if the ones in the old EU who are really interested in reforming the CAP, if they mean it seriously, they should try to organize a reform front in the EU, including the new countries, particularly in this case Poland. Another example, the Polish pension reforms, a reform that was done a couple of years ago, is a success story, and I know it has been studied in some Western European countries. I don't know whether that has been used in these countries as a useful example. I don't know. I guess, but this is only a speculation, I guess that there are some mental problems because while the East knows that it can learn a lot from the West, the West needs some time to realize that it also can learn from the East sometimes. So there is an East-West asymmetry in the European Union.
Could one say old Europe versus new Europe?
Well, yes, this is a political slogan, and this is why I don't use it. Well, actually, things are more complicated, also particularly in the economy. Also, politically, things are much more complicated.
One more question for the ambassador. Right there.
You mentioned the European neighborhood policy and that is failing, and essentially Europe has no strategy for the extended larger Eastern Europe. And we've heard here there's Georgia, there's Ukraine, there's Russia, all in the middle of transition or failing or not. What should the European Union do? What must the European Union do to offer an incentive for these countries to pursue market reforms if they cannot offer membership like they did to Poland or the Czech Republic?
Well, yeah. As I said, the problem with the EU is that it is successful if it can offer the incentive of membership, but it cannot offer the incentive of membership to the rest of the world. That doesn't work. So the problem is what to do with other countries that cannot be included, that cannot be taken into the European Union. But first, there are countries that can be and should be taken into the European Union. One day, I believe that Ukraine is such a country. And second, the problem is that the European Union, first, cannot be forever a civilian power only and be proud, so to speak, of being a civilian power only with very little hard power. It needs hard power. Second, the European Union can only be successful in this strategy towards such regions if it works together with the United States. The former Soviet Union is not a playground for a competition between the EU and the US. This is an ideal place, an ideal place for a cooperation between the EU and the and the US for a lot of reasons that I cannot analyze now. And there are some elements of good cooperation. And I believe very much that this is really where we need a community of a community of free countries sponsored, so to speak, by the US and by the European Union. That requires a little more modest approach on the EU side, a little more realistic approach. I think that the chance is pretty good that the European Union will become more realistic. I think it has become more realistic. It has become more realistic after the experiences with the war in Iraq. I don't want to discuss who was right, who was wrong, but the EU has recognized that it has failed to offer an alternative strategy. And this is why the European Union, means some leading countries of the European Union today, are much more realistic in their analysis of the international situation.
Okay, let's open it up. More questions to come. Yes, sir, right in front.
I'm Bob Hershey. I'm a consultant. Could you comment on the progress of energy reform in these countries?
Yes. Roughly speaking, the extent to which energy systems have been reformed, both in terms of price and in terms of ownership and regulation and so forth, it is more or less ranked the same way that general progress in transition. I mean, it is about as complete a set of reforms as you can imagine in Central Europe, and it's still a long way in the Central Asian republics and Russia and Ukraine, you know, huge energy subsidies. There's a reason for energy reform being delayed even longer than others. If you talk about incomplete price liberalization or reform in general liberalization, leaving open rent-seeking opportunities, I mean, the king of rent-seeking opportunities is the energy sector in that part of the world, at least it has been. Just a little twist on this. There are a couple of countries who, when they joined the Western European community called the European Union, had to deliberalize their energy policy a little bit. Degree of liberalization of imports and unregulated provision of energy and so forth was too much for the in Estonia was too much for the EU regulations. So there's actually some, if you talk about some kind of a spectrum or index of liberality, there was some movement back to slightly less liberal regimes, not only in energy but in other areas for countries like Estonia and Latvia upon joining the European Union.
More questions? The lady in front.
Linda Greenberg, Brinkman Publishing. Mr. Chibi, I had a question for you in terms of the handout. In talking about all the things that had gone up, the last sentence and the next to last paragraph, the integrity of the legal system and protection of private property rights, however, had declined from 1995 to 2004. And I was curious as to how the legal rights would go down in terms of freedom where all the other things were going up.
Oh, okay. You are referring to the Tech Central Station article?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. You would think that you would need a legal basis in order to make sure that everything else was
Yeah, it's a paradox. I really do have a good explanation for it. Basically, what I did was to look at the Economic Freedom of the World report, which is published by the Fraser Institute, and the Fraser Institute looks at five different aspects of economic freedom. One of them is access to sound money, which is to say inflation. The other one is the size of government, how much the government is spending. Third is the freedom to trade. Fourth is the burden of regulation, and the fifth is the rule of law. In all of those, in the past decade, that is to say between 1995 and 2004, Central European countries, and by them Central European countries I mean Poland, Hungary, Czech Republic, and Slovakia, have improved, with the exception of the fifth, where there has been an increase, particularly in corruption. And in fact, the Fraser Index is highly correlated with CPI, that is to say, Corruption Perception Index, published by Transparency International, which also found a declining trend when it comes to prevalence or perception of corruption in Central Europe. Now, the hypothesis which I'm trying to address in a forthcoming Cato paper is that this is because the transition in Central Europe is not finished, that the number of licensing procedures and intervening steps that present an opportunity for bureaucracies in Central Europe, for bureaucrats to misuse public office for private gain, are still there, and consequently corruption persists. In some cases, it got worse. Next month, I will have a paper on the subject, and hopefully I will be able to explain in greater detail. Okay, we have one more question, so why don't we take a question over there, sir?
I agree with your thrust.
Just a second.
In terms of inclusionary capitalism, capitalism for everyone. And you mentioned that there were no models that existed prior to the collapse of the Soviet Union. But are you aware of the writings of Louis Kelso and Mortimer Adler in the Capitalist Manifesto, and the New Capitalists? And there are many writings in Kelso's Binary Economics. You can go to his website, kelsoinstitute.org. But there you have a model which sustains free markets. As a matter of fact, builds a political constituency for a free market system, private property and limited government. But it looks at the barriers to ownership. In other words, even if you look at the American economy, which you could say has about as broad a base of capital ownership as any country, the top 1% own about 50% of all corporate equity.
Let's go to the question very quickly so that we can get maybe another one in.
Mm-hmm. Or not?
Simple answer. I am not familiar with the Capitalist Manifesto. But I think I want to correct perhaps a misimpression. I am not one of those who argue that the problem at the beginning was that there were no models. In fact, I think that was a red herring. Some academics believed it with good motivation, but a lot of previous elite members, as the ambassador said, didn't believe it, but for other motivations, simply wanted to postpone reform. I think the issue was, and it wasn't, the debate wasn't actually whether there is a model or not. The debate was a little finer than that, because the debate was, first of all, we know what capitalism looks like because there's lots of it, lots of examples in the world. We don't know how to go from socialism to capitalism. So it was a debate about the mechanics of the dynamics of the movement from one model to another. And then the other part of the debate was even finer than that, and this was the Big Bang versus gradualism. What is the optimal way of going there, quickly or slowly? But here, let me pick up on what the ambassador said, which I agree fully, that the gradualist notion was very often a pretext for old elites to avoid reform. Lots of academics have written about that, and it would be to blame them for that would be like blaming, if you were, say, anti-nuclear in your Weltanschauung, it would be like blaming Einstein for there being nuclear power and nuclear bombs. it's not their fault, except maybe that they were a little bit, shall we say, naive about how the local elites and traditional elites would use this. They used it and abused it, and I have a test of this in my book, which basically uses quantitative indicators of different types of reform, price liberalization or market liberalization type of reforms, and institutional reforms. If anybody who moved slowly was seriously following the academic recommendations of gradualist academics, they should have moved slowly on liberalization but moved fast on institutions. Guess what? They didn't. Not only that, those who moved fast on economic liberalization were also the ones who moved fast on institutional reform.
Thank you so much. I would once again urge you all who are interested in the subject matter to buy Divergent Paths. And also I want to tell you that the presentation of Dr. Havrilishin will be on Cato's Project on Global Economic Liberty website for you to check out later. Now let me invite you upstairs for refreshments, and in the meantime, let me thank Oleg for a wonderful presentation.